Hello!
Hello, I'm Max.
I'm Des.
And this is the Extraordinary Brains podcast.
Yeah.
And we're a bit hyped because we just interviewed a really interesting person for next week's episode.
But you're going to have to keep an eye out, eye open for that one.
Spoilers. Yeah. But this one that we're putting out today is a super interesting one because we cannot tell you exactly who it is.
Ooh.
Because, now, Aiden, we can say, use his first name.
Can we?
Cool. Has experienced some prejudice and negativity in his profession about his neurodiversity, although not about his other identities. And he asked us for him to remain semi-anonymous.
Yeah, I mean, you don't want to... If he hasn't told people, we're not going to be the one to tell him.
No.
That's not our responsibility.
But I think it is one to share. I don't think he'd mind us sharing, because the fact that somebody who is so professional and so kind and so intelligent isn't comfortable with sharing his neurodiversity is really sad and really a kind of... It's a real reflection of the fact that in large parts of society, attitudes have not moved on yet. So really fun interview with him. But there's a little bit of sadness there that he's not quite able to be open.
Yeah. I mean, that is sad, but it was a very good interview. I really enjoyed it.
You and he really hit it off.
Okay.
Well, no, I mean, you just did, didn't you?
Yeah, it was very nice to speak to him.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, you just said me, like as if you didn't.
Well, no, that's a fair point, but I mean, I sort of expected...
Yeah, you and him really had a nice time, didn't you? I felt a little bit left out.
No, I mean, I suppose I know him a little bit already, and we're in the same profession, so I was expecting to get on with him, but I didn't know that you and he would get on as well as you had. I'm just trying to say how well you got on with him.
Okay.
Oh, man, everyone's a critic. All right, well, we better go on with the episode.
Yes, so we'll see you in the outro, I guess.
Yeah. Right, welcome. so today we have an episode which is, yes, thank you, Tess. It's very different in several ways. First of all, most importantly, our guest today is identifying as a medical student. He does have a name, but we'll get into it. And actually, just by identifying yourself as a medical student, I do think you're underselling yourself really quite significantly. Not that I know everything that you've achieved so far, but I would make that observation to start with. But the second thing that's different about this episode is that Tess and I, although we're in the same house, are not in the same room because Tess has COVID, do you not?
I think I can kind of tell that this is lagging quite a bit.
Oh, you're sort of taking your voice away.
I said welcome at the same time as Dad, and then like 5 seconds later he said, yes, thank you, Tess. So that's a very good indicator to me that we're not having the best time with internet right
It's
now.
A pretty good indicator. There's something... guest person, welcome.
Hey all, lovely to be here. Thanks for having me.
I'm going to start with Tess, and you can, Tess, if you could ask the first question for us.
I can in fact do that, if you can hear what I'm saying over the dog barking. Thinking about when you were growing up, when did you become aware of being different to other people, and how did that feel?
Oh, see, that's a very open-ended question. I always felt different to people, and that's for a number of reasons. The first is I'm gay. So being queer or LGBTQIA, which funnily enough, there's the crossover of Venn diagrams between people who are have diverse genders and sexualities and people who are neurodivergent is a massive crossover. So that's the first one. But I think even as a kid, I was definitely sort of, I don't know if praised is the right word, but definitely kind of the way I spoke to adults. Adults treated me differently to other kids, and definitely I didn't quite fit in that normally with other kids. I definitely viewed things differently and thought differently to kids my age, particularly when I was younger.
And what do you mean by that? What sort of, in what ways did you think differently to other people?
Oh, that's a good question. I think I struggled probably relating to kids my own age and socializing with kids my own age. I think if I would have been born today, I probably would have been diagnosed with a very high functioning kind of mild case of someone with autism spectrum. But I sort of grew out of those tendencies, I guess. You know, I used to have like tactile hypersensitivity. I used to take all my clothes off to go to the toilet. I used to tell very elaborate, you know, 1 hour long stories with, you know, toys just by myself, kind of. I would happily entertain myself with toys. I wasn't really interested in playing much with other kids. I was a lot more interested in playing alongside other kids, but doing my own thing.
And how did that progress through kind of school and then, because medicine's not your first profession, is it?
No, yeah. I mean, it's interesting. It's sort of, I don't want to say I grew out of it, but I sort of learned to socialize better and kind of normalize myself in my behaviors more as I grew up. Certainly my thinking, and like, I know that oftentimes just in group activities and the way I interact with groups and people, everyone has unique perspectives, but I probably think slightly differently to most people and tend to have a better understanding of how systems interact with each other. It also means I'm very bad at learning discrete things which don't interact as a system. So I'm shocking when it comes to brute force memory. You know, that's not a strong suit, but things kind of click well for me, particularly when I've become interested in things. So I've always had hyper focuses as a kid. You know, I fell in love with fish tanks and tropical fish when I was young, and that lasted about kind of 5 years, and I just became obsessed. And I used to walk into like aquarium shops and have in-depth discussions. You know, I used to be able to tell you every breed, their different breeding habits. I used to breed tropical fish. I was obsessed with it. You know, nerdy kids are, you know, my mates had PlayStations. I had, you know, tropical fish tanks. Then I became really obsessed with, you know, like DJing and audio equipment and stuff. Then I became really interested in theology for a few years and, you know, was 12 or 13 and then, you know, doing Reiki and, you know, having conversations about Wicca versus neo-paganism versus, you know, traditional religions. And then when I was 14, I was a depressed, closeted little gay kid at school, and I found an ad for St. John Ambulance Cadets. And I went to my first meeting, and they gave me a first aid textbook, and overnight I devoured the whole thing. And I could barely focus in school, but I just took this home and devoured it, and it just clicked. I thought, oh, that just, like, I like that. My brain tends to think in hierarchies and flowcharts, so, you know, like I would spend hours on Wikipedia and could easily learn the insignia and rank markings and ranks of kind of every country's military and you know, different things like that. Because hierarchies just make a lot of sense in terms of systems.
Because there's a structure there rather than the sort of brute. And I get it. Because people would say, well, that isn't that the very definition of brute force memory, but it's not, is it?
It's totally the opposite. It's situational, contextual. It's everything relates to each other. It's not discrete. You've got a captain who sits below a major, but above a lieutenant. And historically that makes sense because the captain was the head of a company. And you know, it derived itself from, you know, naval terms. And then you had colonels, which came from coronello, which came from coronet, which meant crown. And it was the representative of the crown on a certain piece of land. And then, you know, between captain and colonel, they had to come up with something else. And so they had the major captain or capitano di maggiore. And then, yeah, so, yeah, you know, it all fits together and makes sense really nicely.
A bigger picture in it itself is kind of a really something that kind of, I think, creates a lot of develops a lot of hyperfixations in neurodivergent people. Like, I've had that with lots of sorry, I'm talking a bit weird today. When you go into like a fandom, this is a really weird example, when there's a fandom of like a show or something like that, and there's loads of, or a game, and there's like lore and there's like stories behind the scenes, and as you learn more and more about it, it starts to all piece together in your head. And you go into the details and you start putting it all together, and it's really satisfying as well, which I think
Just makes me think of a few. Just the whole conversation makes me think of a few things. One is obviously my slightly obsessive board game thing, which is all about systems and hierarchies. Second is the difference between how great your brain is, Tess, at lore and understanding gorillas, for instance. Not gorillas the band, not well, necessarily gorillas the primate, although nothing against gorillas the primate. And the third thing is, of all the things I thought we might talk about, I do think the etymology of military ranks is probably low on the list, but there you go.
Not bad. I'm really not.
Yeah, I mean, what I will say, though, is it's really cool to speak to someone who's a bit younger than me, but who's kind of like about to step into the world that I like in terms of generations. Like, I'm just stepping out of kind of my teenage young adolescence. Like, I turn 27 next year, and you're just stepping into like your young adult space, which is so it's really cool. I feel like I get to pass down a few like, oh, by the way, like, look out for this. What I will say is being... There was a funny period of time kind of just before COVID where between kind of 18 and 24 years old, I was going to medical conferences all the time, and being an outsider on the inside, which has kind of been an ongoing theme for most of my life, I guess, that ability to apply that kind of hyperfixation with law and LORE law, kind of game law or fictional law, also meant I was able to apply it to the social dynamics of the social media medical community. So I could network, and I've been able to network really, really well, because when it comes to normal day-to-day stuff, if it's not something that's a particular interest, I'm really bad when it comes to faces and names and remembering people's names. I'll remember kind of interesting tidbits about them. Like, oh yes, you're the person who was telling me that they had to go on holiday and left their dog with a weird like babysitter and couldn't get a video conference, or the dog came back really fat. Like, I'll remember that, but I won't remember your name.
That sounds like a very good story.
Yeah. But what it does mean is that when I am particularly like interested, and it's not that I can choose to be or not, you know, you're just following the dopamine really. But when I am interested, it meant that, you know, I could walk into a room and quite a few friends have been kind of gobsmacked that I'll walk into a medical conference room and just, it feels like something out of the West Wing, which is a show you probably haven't seen, Tess. I'd be very impressed if you have. Yeah, it's a great show. It's about like, it's an alternative universe where there's a good president in charge of the United States. And it's about like what goes on inside his office. But I can kind of walk into a medical conference room with 6,000 people and work the room and navigate and remember, oh, hey, how are you going? How's that project you're working on? I really love that tweet you made the other day. This is my friend so-and-so. And just kind of, I've got like a Rolodex of cards that I can kind of put people into. And that's really useful. And that's been an incredibly useful skill that I've noticed that I tend to have better ability to do than most people. And it's not something I've worked on, and it's not something I can choose to turn on or turn off, but it just happens.
I mean, I would really love to come back to this when we get to the fifth question, because
yeah, sure,
you're saying something really interesting here. But I just want to come back to something that you said like at the start of this question, where you said that teachers treated you differently when you're in school. So what did that look like for you?
I was a very goody-two-shoe kind of kid, and I used to kind of suck up to teachers a bit because I kind of wanted them to be my friends, because I don't think I socialized particularly well with other kids. I was one of those like kids who like was the English teacher's favorite sort of thing. I was never disruptive, but looking back, perhaps I was disruptive, but in a way that was socially acceptable, in that I'd ask lots of questions and I would answer questions a lot, and I would kind of politely interrupt to ask about things that interested me. But I was very lucky that I had really good teachers growing up, and I was, yeah, I didn't have the kind of, I mean, it's quite interesting going through the process of getting my diagnosis and going through all my school reports, looking back, you know, they all say, Aiden's a pleasure to have in class. He's always so engaged, but he really needs to learn, you know, not to ask so many questions or to not have so many discussions with his peers, you know, perhaps to learn when to interrupt or not interrupt, or to, you know, to be more quiet in class. You know, I love how engaged Aiden is, but sometimes he can just be too talkative. So, you know, it was quite funny
that's
looking
pretty,
through that.
That's pretty familiar. Both.
Yeah,
both,
that, both. I'm just thinking to myself, that does sound like something I may have heard a couple of times.
Yeah, but I never got really into trouble for it. Like, I was never in trouble. Teachers, you know, all my teachers loved me except my sports teacher. I failed PE a few years, which was...
Always a sports teacher.
Yeah, I think that's more the queer thing than the ADHD thing. yeah.
How do you mean it was the queer thing? So I might have missed something there.
Like kind of the token gay kid who didn't really like sports, which is really funny because now I'm a lot more sporty than I ever used to be. Like, you know, I do jujitsu and did MMA and Krav Maga and a bit of kickboxing and gym. And
I mean, but that's way more interesting than the stuff you do in like in PE. That's yeah. way more interesting.
But again, it's not, none of them are particularly kind of team sports. I think I got very easily bored in PE and didn't, you know, there's all sorts of things like the minority stress when you don't know that you're a queer kid, but you still feel very stressed and out of sorts in a conventionally heteronormative hypermasculine environment where there's certain expectations around your behavior as a boy with the rest of the boys.
And those expectations are amplified by the fact that it's physical education. Do you think that's where the sort of queer mismatch with PE came in? Particularly, presumably, in Australia.
Every other subject is a safe space in terms of for an academic, but suddenly I can't be friends with the girls. I have to get on with the boys. And for a lot of my kind of early education, I just was friends with the girls and had very few guy friends who I would hang out with during the day.
But there is also a mismatch in PE particularly with team sports and neurodiversity. I think there seems to me to be a difficulty. I mean, obviously there are neurodiverse people who are brilliant at team sports, and I meet them regularly, but there does seem to be a problem with team sports and neurodiversity, which puts a lot of people off physical activity altogether in a way that's quite unhelpful.
Like,
I don't know what you think, Tess.
What do you mean by that, Dad? Like, what kind of aspect? What is the aspect of team sports that makes it more difficult for neurodivergent people?
It sort of depends on the neurodiversity, but a lot of the autistic kids I work with just really can't get on with team sports because of the unwritten rules, the need for subtle amounts of... I'm not saying they can't cooperate, because that's a really awful thing to say about autistic people, but
100%.
the subtleties of cooperation that are often... not explicitly stated, but you get in a huge amount of trouble for not complying with. So you know, you start getting yelled at by your teammates for not doing a thing that you didn't really know that you had to do because you hadn't been explicitly told to do it, for instance. I think with ADHD, I mean, again, this isn't always the case, but often it's the fact that there's an awful lot of listening actually in team sports that needs to be done, and a lot of listening to complex. Well, yeah, why don't you tell me about it, Tess, your rugby career?
I actually just got a notification on my phone that I need to start getting ready for rugby, or I would if I didn't currently have COVID.
Or if they hadn't actually cancelled all the rugby training because of COVID.
I know. I do really struggle with the cooperation part of the rugby quite a lot, because I get past the ball and I just stand there for a second, I'm holding it, and they're like, Tess, over here, and I'm like, ah! And then next thing I know, I'm on the floor and there's people stamping on my face or something. I don't know. Definitely going off track here.
I think, and I totally hear you, that if I didn't have people competing for trying to tell me what to do in that split second, I would happily be able to make a choice.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
But knowing that I'm unsure and have to think, but then people are trying to tell me stuff at the same time, is very confusing, and it's cognitively overwhelming. I can't process that quickly, that many competing demands. But more so, I think being in a team sport means that at the end of the day, a lot of what you do doesn't directly affect the outcome. And I find that I tend to get quite disinterested in things where I can't see how my actions affect the outcome. And for the same reason, I think I sometimes struggle with some rules because I don't see how they make sense in context. Mm-hmm. And I know that's definitely a lot more common amongst, people on the spectrum and autistic people. But I think I've never been particularly good at or liked following rules as such when I didn't understand why they were there, or I thought they were wrong. And I've never been particularly good at doing things when I didn't see a clear relationship between what I was doing and the eventual outcome.
Yeah.
And so I find it quite boring being on a team when you can't see how your actions impact the final outcome in a very direct way.
We might be getting ahead of ourselves, but how does that play into you as part of a medical team or part of a kind of a clinical team generally? Healthy ability to challenge authority, perhaps we could call it, is that still causing problems? Is it a strength? How do you see it? How do you see that side now? Unless we want to leave that.
It's probably my greatest strength and my greatest weakness. It allows me to innovate and do things which almost no one else can do because I am willing to bend things. And so it allows me to offer patients care that very few people are willing to do. But at the same time, it's something that I'm very conscious of and cautious with and surround myself with very experienced, good mentors so that I don't stray outside what is okay.
Mm.
And it's something I'm really working on a lot in terms of my professional development. Probably the key is what is and isn't okay. Because nudging the envelope's okay and even pushing it is okay, but there are boundaries and you can push the envelope, but you can't step outside the envelope because then it actually becomes a question of a why. And oftentimes that can come from a space of ego, I think.
Yeah.
And so the older I get, I'm not becoming more conservative, but I'm definitely understanding more and more how I should be looking at system-based change rather than individual-based change. Coming back to your question of how I work on teams, I work really well on teams because I tend to choose to only work in medical areas where I understand how my actions impact end outcomes. Working in a sleep clinic, as a student, I realized very quickly that if I didn't set things up really well, they'd be uncomfortable and people would rip them off halfway in the night and that would have a massive impact on their diagnosis. So fine, I was motivated to do well. As a paramedic, I understand based on the reaction that my patient has, whether, what I've done is, basically what I do is important. Mm. So, I have a sense of pride in what I do And so I enjoy doing it. And same for clinical teams and working with other peers and.
And I suppose just to connect back into your networking ability, that will create for you a bit of a shield of senior people who are willing to bat for you if you do push the envelope and ruffle feathers. So I think it's a good combination, isn't it? It's something that I've never been
particularly. Yeah, and it has, because I have made mistakes.
Yeah.
And thank God I've always had, when I've pushed the envelope, I've generally always had patience at the forefront of why I was doing it. And certainly no patient has ever been harmed and most have had actually benefit by that. But I have kind of burned my hands a bit here and there and have learned really valuable lessons from it.
Okay. I don't know if this is even worth discussing, but you mentioned when you were 14, you were a closeted gay kid who went into the St. John's ambulance. When did you stop being a closeted gay kid and become an openly gay kid? And is that relevant to this journey that you've been on, or is that just something that you think is separate to your neurodiversity journey?
I don't know that I can pry them apart. I don't know that I can necessarily say that my identity is informed by this percentage of this and that percentage of that. I came out when I was 18, at the end of high school. I was still in high school. Really positive experience, was phenomenally well received. I was incredibly lucky and to this day really appreciate how wonderful everyone in my community was. I mean, at 14, I wasn't even sure that I was gay. I probably only realized when I was 16, came out to myself as such. I don't know that one can necessarily differentiate between the intersections of neurodivergence and queer identity. I think the gifts and the unique perspectives they give me are overlapping.
So it's probably time for our second question then, which is about your journey towards, well, Tess, let me not spoil it for you.
All right. So what was your process towards understanding your difference once you, well, you said that you'd always known that you were different, but what was the process once you'd kind of come to terms with that, I suppose?
Yeah, I guess I'd grappled with like on and off depression and anxiety for years, kind of. Seeing various psychologists and everything. And I was in a really good place in medical school. But COVID hit. And I've never really particularly enjoyed learning online, which is to say that it's my absolute Achilles heel and I freaking hate it. And I really struggle learning outside of a team in-person environment. And it got to the point where we had all-day anatomy, which meant every Wednesday we had anatomy from 9 till 5.
All-day anatomy is not as fun as it sounds to non-medical people.
Yeah, I mean, all-day anatomy in a cadaver lab is exhausting. 2 hours of anatomy. It's really not. I promise you, Tess, if ever someone offers it to you, don't say yes. It's not fun. You know, it's certainly not a golden ticket to Willy Wonka's Chocolate Factory. Quite the opposite. It's hell. It's punishing, and if there's a way to get out of it, strongly recommend you take the other course. The human body is very interesting in small chunks, 9 to 5 for an entire day, not one of them. So anatomy for 2 to 4 hours in person in a cadaver lab is fine. Yeah. It's exhausting. No one does not find that exhausting. Up and rotating through it is exhausting. But then replacing that with Zoom 9 to 5 is about the least interactive experience I think you could possibly imagine. And I just could not connect. It was not happening. I got halfway through the year this year, actually. I got to June and I thought, I have actually been logging in on Zoom and then leaving my computer where it is and leaving the room for most of the day.
I think it might be time for me to leave and for Tess to just tell you about her experience.
And I know that's not an uncommon experience for everyone on Zoom this year, because I really empathize strongly with everyone going through high school, because I was doing the same thing, which is I would spend the day on my phone and just use my computer to log in. So my name was on the screen, but I was the opposite of engaged. I wasn't disengaged. I was functionally not present, despite my best efforts, despite trying a number of tricks. Like I tried rewarding myself with 5-minute intervals, you know, pay attention for 5 minutes, then give yourself a chocolate, stand up at your desk, draw what they're talking about, make drawings, even just go to like half of a lecture twice in the day. I really tried to make it as easy for myself, but across the board, I found my attention capacity was just diminishing to the point where I couldn't make it through a 90-second mini tutorial on YouTube without losing focus. And I thought, this is getting ridiculous. And at the same time, I was on TikTok. At first, it was a joke. And then I sort of became hooked, and my friends were on TikTok. And we used to, that's how they get you, Tess. Every time. First, you join as a parody, and then you become that which you
that which you seek to mock.
And so I was on TikTok and I was on with a bunch of friends, and TikTok started sending me a lot of ADHD content, like a lot of ADHD content. And at first I thought it was a joke, and then I was like, oh, I relate to that a lot. And I'd send it to other friends, and it really doesn't help, because there's a meme where it's like, one depressed friend goes to the other depressed friend, oh, life is so shit at the moment. Excuse my French. And the second depressed friend goes, yeah, but I think that's really normal because I feel the same way. And they both go, oh, okay. And then they continue being depressed without recognizing that that's actually not normal.
Yes, yes.
That's a good point.
And I'll come back to that. But essentially, TikTok started feeding me a ridiculously high amount of ADHD content. And I started going, oh, this is really relatable. Ha ha. Oh, this is really relatable.
It's funny how they do. And then I...
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, TikTok's really good. It doesn't know what it's doing, but it's just feeding you algorithmic information based on what it perceives you to have commonality with. And algorithmically, it's really good at diagnosing people with borderline personality disorder, people who are gay or bisexual and don't know it, people who are ADHD. Like, there are thousands of people around the world who have now gotten their diagnosis formally from professionals who, you know, the gateway was TikTok.
Mm.
Anyway, so there was TikTok. Then I was chatting to Mike Facher on Twitter. And he's a wonderful human being.
He is a wonderful, because I've had to say Mike Facher is a wonderful human being, and leave it there.
Honestly, we could just leave it there and go, okay, end of podcast. Thank you for coming. But he's an awesome dude and a wonderful friend. And he sent me Max, Tess, your dad's blog, and goes, well, you know, before you jump to any conclusions, why don't you just read about this? And I read the blog and I was like, oh, and apologies for my croaky voice. I've got a non-COVID, recovering from a non-COVID cough. Mm. And I read the blog and I went, oh, that's really close to home. And then there was a guy in my year at med school who started tweeting and Instagramming about his own experience being ADHD. And I was like, oh, this is really, I'm very careful not to diagnose myself with stuff, but, you know, it got to the point where my best friend and I were joking on a daily basis about me being ADHD.
Exactly.
And so I went to, you know, which is always a good sign. You know, he's also in med school and previously studied psychology and works as a peer counselor. And, you know, we're not complete kind of muggles in terms of healthcare. Well, I mean, I joke, but like, medical people are not normal. If you're in healthcare, like, you're not normal. And then whenever I meet someone's partner who's, you know, one of my healthcare mates' partners who's not in healthcare, I meet them and I go, oh, what do you do? And they go, you know, like, teaching or business. I go, oh, you're normal. Lovely to meet you.
Well, teachers would say that no one in teaching is normal. So it's to an extent a matter of just perspective.
Yeah. Anyway, so, I went to my psychologist and I brought it up with him and he kind of shut me down straight away. And he was like, oh no, this is just, you know, you can't distinguish. You've just got like ongoing low level depression, anxiety. It's COVID. This is something you've dealt with before. Maybe if you go through your school records, why don't we have a look through them? But honestly, I think you need to focus more on, he was kind of like, Aiden, the problem is if I give you a diagnosis, then you'll have a crutch to blame things on. And that's not healthy because then you won't learn proper coping mechanisms.
Ooh.
And now this guy's a very brilliant, internationally renowned professor of psychology. He's not your average psychologist. And to be honest, he has known me for 10 years. And that was a fair comment to make to me at the time.
Yeah. Okay.
In retrospect, it was quite harmful, so maybe I am letting him off the hook a bit. But he did have a point, which is I do have a tendency to externalize things and go, oh, well, it's all a bit too hard, I guess. But that was probably part of my coping mechanism as an undiagnosed ADHD kid my whole life.
Mm.
So anyway, then I spoke to my GP. And he was like, look, I really don't think you have ADHD, but my GP's awesome. And he said, look, I'm never going to say no to giving you a referral to a psychiatrist. So find one you like and I'll give you a referral. So I shopped around and found this psychiatrist who did healthcare professionals, adult ADHD and PTSD in veterans. And I thought, this is a good mix. Yeah, adult ADHD is not a common thing. And he does healthcare professionals. That's pretty cool. He had a pretty long waiting list. The waiting list in Australia for psychiatrists, which is essentially private, is 6 months. Mm-hmm. And that's private. Public is years. You essentially have to be incredibly unwell mentally to see a public psychiatrist. And it's usually only in a hospital setting. So I spoke to his secretary and I was like, I'm a medical student. I'm really struggling. And she was like, oh, you know what? Let me see if I've got a cancellation for you. I got a referral from my GP and she had a cancellation the next day.
Wow.
Like called me half an hour before and said, look, I'm calling you half an hour before. I'm not expecting you to be available, but if you are, I've got a cancellation in half an hour's time. I said, yes, I'll take it. I'll miss whatever I've got. I spent an hour with him. He's a brilliant psychiatrist. And I went through my entire life story and it was over Zoom. And he turns to me and goes, look, mate, I haven't reviewed your school records, but I'm fairly happy to make a presumptive diagnosis at this point that you've got mild to moderate ADHD. Mm. And I was kind of like, oh, at that point it was almost such a relief to have someone validate my experience. Cause I kind of turned to him and I said, look, I don't need the label. I don't need Ritalin or an amphetamine. I just need 10% more functionality because I'm not functioning. I'm not getting through any of my homework, any of my study. I'm not doing invoices. I'm not getting through bills. Administration has always been my nightmare. Mm. You know, I've forgotten to invoice people for half the things I've done over the past 25 years, yeah. 26 years. I said, I just need 10% more functionality. So he goes, yeah, look, that's fine. But I'm giving you the diagnosis anyway, and you can do with it what you like. Would you like some Ritalin?
Mm.
And I said, you know, I get palpitations after I have a strong coffee.
Yeah.
I'm not sure an amphetamine's the best route for me to go, and I'm not sure I'm necessarily experiencing a severe enough. I went in there understanding that my neurodivergence was a gift and that I had thrived in academia, but that I had now put myself into a situation which was medical school, yeah. which was a very neurotypical environment, and that I had to get through the next few years, yeah. and that might involve medication. And I was very happy to understand that I might have to medicate myself mildly into neurotypicalism in order to get through something that I felt was essential to my life course. And then I could go back to being a bit more divergent in the way I live my life. And I was very okay with that. And it's problematic, but for me, I made that decision for myself. You know, I'm a very oddly shaped peg and I had to fit into a very square hole for a bit.
Yeah.
And I just needed a few tools to do yeah. that. And I'd been doing quite a lot of reading and I'd come across atomoxetine. And I sort of raised atomoxetine with him. And atomoxetine is this selective noradrenaline reuptake inhibitor. It's got a bit of dopaminergic properties, a bit of serotonin properties. Basically, no one's really sure how it works, which is fairly common for all psychiatric medications, but they tend to use it in people who can't use amphetamines. It's probably not as effective.
Mm.
Certainly, it's less strong, but it's got a short-term effect, which is the effect that day, but also like a long-term antidepressant, anti-anxiety-like effect in that it's kind of an anti-ADHD, neurodivergent difficulty with chronological time processing and remembering to do things effect. And so I asked him about that and he kind of laughed because he goes, you're the only person who's ever asked me for a diagnosis as such and then said they don't want amphetamines.
Mm.
and he was like, yeah, of course, mate, happy to prescribe it. Let's see how you go. Went through a whole thing around, you know, what was, you know, red flags for the medication. And I started it. And within 2 weeks, my life had changed.
Mm, go on.
I went from, usually I would prepare one of my clinical tutorials the morning of. I'd wake up like 15 minutes before and we all had to prepare like 15 minute presentations. And I'd be doing, writing my PowerPoint while someone else was presenting.
Yeah.
So it was cobbled together at the last minute. I'm very good at last minute stuff. But I went from that to the next Sunday, I had finished it ready for the Wednesday.
And that's a big difference. It may not sound much to neurotypical people, but that's a huge difference.
In my life, I have never, ever had a presentation prepared 3 days before it was due for something that I wasn't incredibly passionate about, ever. Like it was always the night before. I never had the intrinsic motivation to be able to do something without the pressure the night before ever in my life. So that was an incredibly affirming experience. That was July, August, probably August this year, was when I started atomoxetine and started recognizing that I was someone who had ADHD.
And it's interesting, the amphetamine, the, I mean, we can probably talk a little bit about the whole amphetamine thing, because you're right. You're right to sort of name it in that the medication, the stimulant medication, is an amphetamine derivative. And we're a bit shy of saying so in the medical profession. Well, I mean, you know, it's not really. It is definitely, you know, it's sufficiently related that the effect is analogous. It's just really interesting to think about, and this may not be of interest to all of our listeners, but you know, the different ways that different medications and the non-stimulant medications can almost, rather than having an in the moment effect, have a kind of, I almost think of it like slightly rewriting over time, pathways within your brain, in a way that is more subtle. But actually, I'm actually quite a big fan of, and lots of my colleagues don't really rate them, but I think if you can just give yourself a bit of time, there can be a really good way of just moving things in the right direction so that all the stuff you're doing, which is non-pharmacological in terms of strategies and study strategies or social strategies, has time to work as well. So yeah.
And that's the thing. I went in there going, I don't care what it is. I just need 5 to 10% more functionality. Yeah. I don't need to go from nothing to 100. And for me, I felt that in terms of the way I live my life, the things I like doing, the way my brain works, the way I've got sleep issues already where, you know, I often stay up late and like to sleep in. I'm very much a night owl. But, you know, I wrote my entire honors thesis I spent a year writing, you know, entire dissertation between 10:30 p.m. and 3 a.m. in a state of hyperfocus almost every night. It was amazing, but because I loved what I was doing. Yeah. But ask me to be productive at like 8 in the morning. It's not happening. Unfortunately, medical school starts at 8 in the morning. So, you know, it was very easy when I spent a year abroad as a researcher to stay up late and come into the office early. Not so now that I'm in a different career. Mm. What I will say though is having a lot of friends and also speaking to a lot of people online who are adults who have ADHD and who have used amphetamines as party drugs, a lot of them report that they get none of the benefits of, they don't feel the high, they don't feel the rush, they don't feel the increased libido. They kind of just feel calm and will do things like engage in, like, you know, conversation and clean their room and kind of become, you know, interested in the fact that the glass is dirty and it's kind of like a waste of money almost thing. And a lot of, I work as a paramedic in a lot of club music festival environments and I really enjoy it and I spend a lot of time there. And it's fascinating just the relationship between, you know, we always say if you've got, and it's an oversimplification, but it's very common kind of, if you've got ADHD and you take an amphetamine or Ritalin, dexamphetamine, methylphenidate, all those amphetamine-like stimulant ADHD drugs, you tend to feel calm, whereas people without ADHD will feel stimulated. Yeah. The same holds true for party drugs. Yeah. So for Tess, yourself, and people of your age listening, later on in life, if you come across circumstances where, you know, you have the opportunity to experiment with illicit substances, which are amphetamines, I would, beyond the fact that they have risks, I would just say that it's a bit of a waste of money. and I wouldn't really recommend it.
That's a brilliant anti-drugs message. So just that's just not going to work for you. Just steer clear.
Like, you may as well just take two Ritalins and go to the club. You'll have the same amount, you know, it'll have the same effect, but you'll have spent less money.
Yeah.
And you'll be slightly, you'll have less of a you'll have less of a dopamine crash the next day.
Yeah. And there's a danger if you take two Ritalin and then go to the club, you'll spend quite a lot of the time cleaning the tables.
Yeah, you'll notice how disgusting the bathrooms are. Oh God.
So not recommended. That's the kind of anti-drug message we're going for in this podcast. Is it time, do you think, for the third question?
I was just thinking that.
Well,
how do you feel about your difference now, and like, what impact does it have in your life, positively and negatively?
There's only two negatives. Everything else has been a positive because I've recognized how to leverage it for strengths. The same way that after a while I became incredibly grateful for being gay and the gifts it's given me in life. Just the other day, you know, I've had a tough few months with having cared for quite a few people who were victim survivors of sexual assault in a professional capacity as a paramedic. And the majority of them being women, it has been such a gift for me to be gay and to be able to bring an authentic personality of my sexuality to the fore in that clinical environment, because it makes me so much less threatening and it makes me so much more of a safe person. And that's the tip of the iceberg. That's for other people. That doesn't even begin to talk about the gift it's given me in terms of appreciating the perspectives and lives and lived experience of people who aren't part of a heteronormative experience. You know, I'm incredibly, incredibly grateful for the multiple ways in which being gay has given me insight that most people don't have. And in the same kind of avenue, being ADHD has given me gifts that other people don't have. You know, it's, yes, it has its downsides. Yes, it's an extra struggle, but I have skills that and strength that other people don't have. You know, I can understand hierarchies. I can understand systems. I'm really good at understanding systems and designing systems. I was involved in designing a clinical system for St. John Ambulance here in Australia over the past kind of 24 months. And we launched it, and it's now worth something like $16 million, but we run it on pennies because it's a volunteer organization. And I was able to look back and then go, gosh, I'm really proud of that, because, you know, I'm able to understand systems in a way that neurotypical people can't, from multiple different perspectives. And I'm able to kind of have a degree of foresight into it. And yeah, you know, I love my hyperfocus. I love that when I'm passionate about something, I can deep dive for hours. You know, I love that when I'm passionate about something in research, you know, I'm really proud of my honors thesis because I got a really good mark in it. And it was the first time in my life that I'd been able to work on a long-term project and see it to fruition, and sustain interest, you know, that I could dive into hyperfocus for hours on end, just be immersed in kind of research and these weird abstract things. And I got this rush every time I found a weird paper in the back of the internet that kind of contributed to the discussion. And neurotypical people can't do that like we do. They can't, time doesn't stop for them when they have something that they love and they follow the dopamine. However, it also brings its challenges. It's really freaking hard to day-to-day exist in a very document-heavy system like medical school, where I'm expected to do portfolios and keep track of thousands of bits of paper and get people to sign things. And you know, there's different calendars and different rotations, and there's always things which are due, and there's no single calendar. And I've gone back to keeping a written diary on my person at almost all times. I religiously listen to the lectures of Russell Barkley, who I think is brilliant. He's one of the big, like, American ADHD psychology kind of people. And I really, that was a big one for
me. Very much the ADHD guru, isn't he, in the US?
Yeah. Yeah. Kind of applying a lot of what he's said, rejecting what I didn't like and applying what I did. So, you know, I keep a diary, I handwrite in it. I have another book, which is every clinical interaction that I use for reflections and portfolios now. I sync my multiple calendars on Google and transcribe them into my handwritten diary. I'm still learning. I'm still making mistakes. I'm still double booking things. I'm still stuffing up, but much less than I used to. And then the other thing is the prejudice, particularly amongst doctors. I think broader society because they know less about ADHD, they think it's the kid who jumps around the class, because they think about ADHD the same way that people think about autism, in that they think about a 12-year-old boy with Asperger's who plays the piano like a prodigy but can't talk to people.
Yeah, I mean, the Rain Man thing in autism is still strong, isn't it? That kind of stereotype.
I don't know about you, Tess, but when I tell common people that I have ADHD, they're kind of surprised. When I told my friends, they were like, duh, of course. You know, when I told people on Twitter, they were like, obviously. You know, I told mentors and they were like, yeah, I could have told you that 3 years ago, saved you the drama. You know, which is quite funny because people say the same thing when you come out.
Yeah.
you know, when I came out, my parents were surprised. Yeah, but everyone else around me was like, duh. So that was funny. But amongst medical professionals, it's stigmatized.
Yeah.
And I was really disappointed when I told lecturers and they looked at me differently and I could tell that their perspective on me had changed forever. They saw me as a clinical liability. They saw me as someone who was less reliable. And not all of them, but certainly some of them, I read it in their eyes, and maybe it was projecting, maybe it wasn't, maybe it was more, I was reading into it more than necessarily I should have, but I went from being a passionate, driven student who was a bit disorganized to being someone with a pathology.
Mm.
And that was interesting and concerning for me. And being a paramedic and being kind of focused on a career in critical care, probably, it's very easy because there's an ongoing joke that everyone in emergency medicine has ADHD.
Yeah.
You know, emergency medicine is the squirrel profession.
The squirrel profession?
The squirrel is like, we'll be paying attention.
Really,
and then, like
just taking nuts and storing them for the winter test. That's just a funny thing about
emergency
people.
Yeah.
I don't know why.
Yeah, you know, like it's like you'll be talking to there's that like old ADHD kind of like stereotypes, like talking to someone and then like, oh, squirrel.
You're not the squirrel. Which you are seeing the squirrel.
Yeah, I was gonna say. Yeah. I was thinking like a whole what's the name? The one who did like the hedgehogs. What's her name again? Like Tiggy Winkle. That kind of thing.
Oh, I see.
I'm really confused there. I was like, "Is a squirrel?"
Sorry, that's probably a generational. I don't know. I was on a date earlier today, and we were walking by the beach, and I was like, "Oh, crabs!" And he goes, "What?" And of course, I'd become like so excited by the fact that there were these beautiful, like, big black crabs scuttling away, and it became an ongoing joke. And you know, I'll be walking with a friend, and I'll be like, "Oh, lizard!" You know, and I'll just like. I'm just so easily distracted on my walks with friends. It's an ongoing joke. It's probably my most kind of typical feature of having ADHD.
Yeah, I get that on the bus to school. So I will just be sitting there like in complete silence. I'll be like, oh, sheep! It's sheep.
Literally, right?
Every day.
Or like a horse. Or you see like a really, like a yellow buggy or something. Yeah, anyway.
When there's a llama, it's the end of the world.
Yeah, you do love llamas.
Oh,
but the prejudice... So it's... Is it overt or is it unspoken, which is almost worse?
It's unspoken,
I suppose.
I wish, and I've had to then go and do extra work, and I'm experienced in it because I'm experienced making other people feel comfortable as a LGBT person. Mm. When I disclose my sexuality and someone has a negative reaction, it then becomes my extra emotional labor to sort of say something to make them feel that I'm somehow non-threatening and normal. And so it's a very, you know, I'm used to that. I have a frame of reference for that, but certainly speaking to a few lecturers, you know, I said to them, oh, you know, by the way, I just want to let you know, I finally figured out why I've been struggling this year. I've actually got ADHD. And they've gone, oh, and there's just been a look in their eyes. Mm. And I think it's amongst medical professionals, there's this negative stereotype of ADHD as being associated with your unreliable colleagues who go on to develop substance abuse disorders and make mistakes which kill patients.
Yeah.
And I really didn't like that I felt them viewing me like that. And that's one of the reasons why I'm not recording this podcast completely identifying me. Anyone who listens to this and knows me in any form will know exactly who I am. And that's fine. But it's for that reason that we're not going to put my name on the podcast, that if someone Googles my name for the first time, they don't find this, just because I find out at the moment, you know, I've only had my diagnosis for about 5 months. I'm still kind of getting the hang of it. I'm still sounding out. 99% of the people I interact with have a neutral, if not mildly humorous and optimistic kind of positive reaction when I tell them I've got ADHD, because I usually follow up with a joke. You know, I'll say I have ADHD, like, not like, oh, squirrel ADHD, but like, I'm going to end up down a Wikipedia hole and be able to tell you about like the Belarusian, you know, like military excursion in 1654. Which is again, me doing emotional labor on other people's behalves to normalize things. But I think that's just something a lot of us do, because it makes life easier. But yeah, it's definitely interesting. I think maybe medicine is one of the least accepting professions when it comes to people with our own divergence, particularly when there's a diagnostic label attached to it, despite the fact that having my diagnosis means that I'm now, you know, for all intents and purposes, far more neurotypical than I've ever been before.
And you're functioning.
In terms of my ability to get things
done. You're functioning.
Totally. And you know, I can very proudly say, you know, not only am I able to do my own thing, but I struggle most with my own stuff. You know, I can, even at my most ADHD, I can happily run an entire medical tent at a music festival with 12 people reporting to me and seeing 50 patients in 4 hours. You know, I love that environment. I thrive in it. I thrive in the chaos. But, you know, put me in front of a computer and give me a boring assignment. That's difficult.
Yeah, but sources for courses. I mean, one of the strengths, I suppose, of medicine is that there are lots of different paths you can go down, which suits some people. Mm. I suppose I had a question which occurred to me. Your medical school, does your medical school have a explicit inclusive policy for LGBTQ students? I mean, has it got not explicitly inclusive?
It's got an explicit. I go to a Catholic medical school, which is quite interesting.
Ah, right. Okay.
It is a very interesting experience. We've got a secret LGBT society, and it's quite interesting because quite a few of our lecturers are gay as well. On the one hand, it's Catholic, but on the other hand, it's the most supportive university I've ever been at. Like, I sat down with the head of student matters and was like, look, I'm struggling, but I have this diagnosis. And she basically went, yeah, cool. Can you just reply to this email, CCing the learning access team, and they'll process a thing and we'll send you a learning access plan. I got in touch with the learning access team and they basically said, yeah, cool. Look, we don't actually need a letter from your doctor now. We're pretty happy to take it on on faith, on, I forgot what the term is.
Obviously, that would be a word that they would probably use quite often at Catholic medical school.
Yeah. They were like, look, yeah, you've got like an ongoing relationship with us. That's fine. We'll give you, you know, these dispensations and extra time on exams and, you know, extra leeway if you hand in something a few hours late. And, you know, this is a certificate from the central university office that you can give to all your heads of subjects and lecturers. Australia's got very good laws around that. About disability access and learning inclusion. So that's been really good. The queer thing's an interesting one. The medical curriculum itself needs a lot of updating in general across the board. But I haven't experienced any overtly negative things in medical school. I don't think there's been necessarily an overt. Yeah, like the students kind of have had to take it upon ourselves to organize special speaker nights about trans health and you know, sexual health for gender and sex minorities. But it's never been blocked by the university as such. You know, they've just not actively pursued it.
That's really interesting. I mean, I suppose what I was going with the question was, because most sort of secular medical schools would almost by definition have a inclusive kind of, you know, equality and diversity policy, I mean, certainly in the UK, that
There's a policy there, which is just no one can be, no one can be discriminated against on, you know, sex, creed, gender, religion, sexuality, anything.
But
that's kind of a core value.
Yeah.
So I suppose my point would be you should include neurodiversity under that. I mean, I don't think it's certainly covered by disability legislation. But that's discrimination. That's not prejudice. Do you see what I mean? I think you almost need a sort of another layer of protection, because in a sense, discrimination you need to prove, whereas prejudice is a more subtle and no less harmful.
That's really cool.
I don't know.
You're totally right. I haven't thought about that. Yeah, it comes back to in the queer community, we talk about the difference between tolerance and appreciation.
Yeah.
You know, it's very easy to tolerate queer people. It's a whole other thing to appreciate them and celebrate them.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good analogy, isn't it? So in the same sense, we're probably not the only profession that needs to do this, is to move from tolerance to a celebration of neurodiversity. And I think you bring autistic people in as an autistic doctor, it can be really, really difficult. I know colleagues, you know, who have obvious autistic features, and they do really struggle, particularly as the curriculum has moved much towards, what looks like a kind of more friendly, curriculum, which is about communication skills and patient skills, but actually is deeply neurotypical and neuronormative. If we can talk about heteronormative, it's very neuronormative.
Totally. My medical school's gone the exact opposite and I pride themselves on every single person in our cohort being a bright, interactive, communicative, interesting, exceptional communicator kind of.
Yeah.
And I can happily say that of 140 people in my year, I can have a wonderful conversation with 138 of them, which is unheard of for a medical school. But it I have thought about it more increasingly the past year. I do wonder whether they need a quota of people who are terrible communicators and don't intend to go into a medical subspecialty or medical specialty, which requires a lot of patient-facing communication.
Well, I wouldn't even say terrible communicators, just different communicators. I think they're
a danger. You're right. I apologize.
There's a danger that good communication gets... I'm just going to sort of bash this. I know you understand the point, but just to bash it for the listeners' benefit. There's a danger that we end up using the kind of neuronormative style of communication as the only good one. And that does, that will sort of continue to push autistic people out of the public conversation when they do have valid contributions. Now, I there is always a balance. And again, I think it's the same as what you were saying. You know, you have to go within any kind of profession on any kind of project to where your strengths lie. And a person with autism might, there might be some elements of medicine that they find more difficult or areas of medicine where perhaps they would not be as well suited. But at the same time, we can't tell them, we can't tell people where to go and where not to go. And we can't apply our own standards fully of what we see as good communication to people who are different. So it is tricky. And I think we just need to wake up a little bit to the dangers of a new kind of conformity, in a sense.
You're totally right. Thank you for pulling me up on that. I do appreciate it, because that is so true. And it made me think, Tess, I don't know about you, but so many of my friends, I'm a bit older than you, so also like ex-partners, have been neurodivergent, particularly like autistic. I've got a heap of friends and ex-partners who are autistic, and I don't know what it is about like people with a like autistic spectrum and people who are ADHD, but we seem to get along really well.
Birds of a feather. I mean, here's the funny thing. I'm in like a kind of, well, three of my closest friends, we kind of go around in a group sometimes, and what basically happened is I got my diagnosis, my friend got their diagnosis, my other friend got their diagnosis, and the fourth one is still kind of waiting on that kind of confirmation there. So we've kind of, it was a domino effect there. That also happened with the queerness. It was like, oh, I'm gay, oh, I'm gay, oh, I'm gay. And then it was like, and then everyone started questioning their gender. It was a whole thing.
Hilarious.
It was, you know, it's just, we found out how similar we were in those kind of aspects after we'd started being really close.
I mean, yeah, that's so funny. And so in the same way, I got my diagnosis and excitedly told all my friends and then sent three of my friends to my psychiatrist and they all ended up getting their diagnosis. Yeah. And, you know, because we've been sending each other these ADHD TikToks laughing about it for months and months going, ha ha ha, lol, TikTok is sending us, you know, all these like all this ADHD content. How funny. Yeah, like, but it's just, you know, like, everyone gets this content, you know, like, it doesn't mean anything. Lo and behold. yeah.
So, I mean, just to come in, because there probably are, probably not that many people listening, but certainly people I've spoken to who worry that, and it's funny how analogous the three things are. So either that you kind of get this kind of spread of an idea, so the idea of being questioning your gender, if one person questions their gender then everyone starts doing it and you have a kind of huge number of people
contagion effect.
who start to identify differently, and I suppose the same is true of neurodiversity, same is true of sexuality, although I think people are so people are so expecting everyone to question their sexuality at some point, so that's not worried about as much. What's your answer? I mean, I have an answer to this, but what's your answer to people who worry about that process?
I would say to them that we should, I understand where they're coming from, because I too do not like the idea that we over-medicate children, which is that we unnecessarily medicate children with diverse minds in order to make them conform to societal expectations at a young age. But that's very different from giving someone the tools to be able to function and succeed in a society which wasn't designed for them. We don't deprive people who can't use their legs of wheelchairs and force them to crawl simply because they can't naturally walk. Mm. And I don't think it's fair that we deprive neurodivergent people of the tools which are available and the evidence says can assist them to integrate and live and succeed within the narrow parameters of society. The contagion effect is real. But I would say that, you know, we all drink milk. And when I say we, society, you know, society, everyone, as a general broad thing, for hundreds of years, we've all been drinking cow's milk. At one point in time, no one was drinking cow's milk, and someone came along and milked a cow. And then someone else came along and milked a cow, and suddenly it became permissible
to milk a cow.
To milk cows. And now we just think that's normal. I mean, our vegan friends would disagree, and all the strength to them, it probably is abnormal. And, and there's a whole other discussion that we don't need to go into, but it's modeling permissibility. Yes, there's a contagion effect, but that contagion effect is simply that you're presenting people with a way of authentic self-expression and congruence between an intrinsic internal identity and external expression, which they've never had the opportunity to see modeled before, and you're making it okay and normalizing it. So yes, there's going to be a quote-unquote contagion effect. Yes, diagnostic rates are increasing. Yes, the threshold you need to meet to get a diagnosis is decreasing. Yes, gender fluidity is increasing. Yes, you know, diverse sexualities are increasing. Yes, more people are becoming, you know, diagnosed formally with ADHD and then receiving medications. I don't think that's a problem.
No.
As long as at the end of the day, that person's receiving person-centered healthcare from an appropriately qualified professional, it is none of our business what happens there. And if the trends are going up, then it just means the trends are going up, and it just means we're getting better at diagnosing it, and we're getting better at assisting people to live in a way which helps them succeed in a society which we've unfortunately created, which is very, very narrow.
I was thinking that, I'm thinking this for quite a while, that the reason more people are realizing that they're queer and more people are realizing that they're genderqueer and more people are realizing that they're neurodivergent isn't because the rates of people who are queer, genderqueer, neurodivergent is going up. It's because the rate of people knowing about neurodiversity and all those other things.
Exactly.
It's, if you don't know that something exists, you're way less likely to know that you have experienced it or that you have it.
Exactly.
So, like, you might not know that there is, that, like, a girl can like a girl. And so, obviously, you won't know that you like girls because that's not something that you perceive as possible. So once
which is why representation in the media is important.
Once you start being aware of these things, you can kind of start seeing, oh, that's me, that's what's happening with me. And then, obviously, awareness rates go up, diagnosis rates go up, and as more people are being diagnosed, the people around them are becoming aware, and so they're getting diagnosed.
Exactly.
So I don't think it's anything to do with people who have, like, there's more people who have ADHD. I think it's just there's more people who know what ADHD is.
Totally. It reminds me of, I don't know why this just popped into my head, which is a common theme as well. But I was having a discussion with a friend the other day, and he was saying, Aiden, you like to hurry people up in their discussions. And it's something that I notice is that I can get impatient in discussions. I'm like, yeah, get to the point. And I'll sometimes make flippant comments in order to show people that I understand the concept that they're communicating because I want them to keep going, get to the point. And it's something that I'm working on because neurotypical people find it really offensive. And it's unpleasant when you hurry someone up because it to them, they perceive it as devaluing the worth of what they're saying. So that's something that I'm trying to work on personally, is being more attentive to people, not in terms of paying attention, but not rushing people, letting them say their piece. Yeah.
Well, I'm just leaving a pause so that I can check that you've said your piece, Aiden.
Thank you.
No, I mean, I do exactly the same and I'm very bad at it. And I'm a sort of part of the discipline for me of doing this podcast is to not interrupt people.
You know who's very good at interrupting people?
You are.
No, the dog who is
the dog very good at interrupting people. The dog has spent quite a lot of the last hour or so barking at someone.
I'm pretty sure that our microphones have picked it up.
Oh well, I've got skills to sort that out. Don't worry. Is it time for our fourth and penultimate question test?
That is a brilliant idea. So, looking back, is there anything that you wish had been different, like to do with your journey within, like, yourself or the people around you?
I'm really grateful for my life course. I wouldn't change anything going back because it would make me a different person than who I am today. Because if I didn't have the experiences formative as they were, I would be a different person. We wouldn't be having this discussion. You know, butterfly theory, going back in time, you change the course of history, blah, blah, blah. However, I look back at the bouts of depression and anxiety that I've had since I was a young teenager and perhaps even before. And I recognize that the core of that was probably undiagnosed and untreated ADHD.
Yeah.
And that only since starting medication have I been able to implement the cognitive behavioral therapy that I've spent the last 12 years supposedly trying to do and learn. Only since starting medication have I actually been able to be kind to myself, give myself a break, say, that's okay, you've maxed your concentration out at the moment, you'll come back to it later, that's all right, give yourself a day, you're allowed to be anxious, sit in it, experience the feeling, it just is a sensation, move forwards, don't ignore it, don't repress it, just experience it, let it happen, it just is, it's not going to last forever, it just is today, and tomorrow will be different. I wasn't able to do that until I had a diagnosis and until I started medication. And so I look back and I wonder how much of the suffering I went through for years could have been avoided if there was a wider recognition of the more subtle features of ADHD in higher functioning kids with high EQ.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think, not to drop that psychologist in it, but the sort of the fact that they couldn't see it, there is a strong tendency in professions, once you've seen someone in a particular way, in a particular light, to change the way you see your patient or your colleague is really difficult. And we see a lot in conversations with women who get diagnosis of ADHD in adulthood or autism in adulthood, you know, the kind of the years they've had basically being diagnosed with anxiety and depression, which after all is a symptom. It doesn't actually tell you why.
It's a constellation of symptoms which manifest because there's something not right.
And there's a lack of curiosity, I think, generally, but particularly in the caring professions, about, well, okay, someone's got anxiety and depression. What is going on underneath that? We have a tendency to treat the surface. And I have to say CBT is guilty of that, because CBT is, in that sense, quite a superficial way of addressing difficult thoughts and feelings, I would say. But anyway.
Certainly, when you're a practitioner of CBT, you're a hammer and everything looks like a nail.
That's true.
And I've been hammered for 12 years.
Not even in a good way.
As a non-compliant nail. Yeah, no, I haven't. I really don't enjoy alcohol. It doesn't agree with me particularly well. I tend to have like a 3-day flat after I drink alcohol, so I tend not to drink it much at all. I'm now in the process of divorcing kind of my psychologist who's known me since I was 15 years old. Ooh. I'm now about to be 27. And it's an awkward process because essentially he violated the therapeutic relationship that we had when I came to him with legitimate concerns. And he basically said, no, it's not. And I said, I need help. I'm not functioning. It's not anxiety. It's not depression. I'm not getting stuff done. And he couldn't see outside the reference of CBT and just kept trying to CBT me. And this guy is a brilliant guy. Like, he is a fantastic psychologist, has really helped me over the years. You know, he's a brilliant guy and is an excellent clinician. But everyone's human. You know, we can only do so much. We've all got cognitive biases. Yeah. And so now I'm kind of in the process of finding a new psychologist. But it is curious that I did my DAS. There's a depression, anxiety, stress scale test. And it's like a 42-question questionnaire kind of looking at depression, anxiety, and stress levels. And I've been doing one every few months since I was 16 years old. And I did one the other day, the other day being like 2 or 3 months ago. And for the first time in my life, I am below the population baseline for depression, anxiety, and stress.
Wow.
And that was mid end of year. That was during my end of year medical school exams. So that's the equivalent of like mid A levels in terms of stress.
And that's amazing. And that's a transformation that understanding yourself can really have. And another theme of the podcast that, you know, is how understanding your own diversity just is transformational for people's well-being. Thank you for that. That was amazing. Tess, do you want to do the last question?
While I
go and tell the dog to shut up and then I'll come back.
So I accidentally said that I was going to re-bring up your social networking thing in this question. By accident, I actually meant to say the third question, which we've already done, and I didn't bring it up then. So if you want to talk about it now, then please go ahead.
Only in certain spaces. So like at an intensive care conference, when I was really interested in the conference and I love intensive care and that world is new and exciting for me. It's like having a player's kind of deck of different cards or monsters, or I don't know what games you play. It's like having the different characters that you have kind of in your arsenal and like adding stats to each kind of animal or character or monster or whatever.
I play most games. So
as you go.
You're spot on there.
Yeah, I can kind of just like, I'm like, oh, hi, you know, I'm so-and-so, lovely to meet you. Oh, I'm so-and-so. Oh, wonderful. Oh, you know, Professor so-and-so. Oh, I've heard of your work. I read your paper the other day. You know, because I'll just like remember, oh, yeah, like I read their paper on this topic. That's right. They work at this hospital. They know this colleague. I'm like, oh, that's fantastic. I loved that thing you wrote, blah, blah, blah. And then I'll connect who they are on Twitter and I kind of create like a mental map. It's
the piecing together the information when I was learning, as well.
Yeah. And when I was doing my A-levels in chemistry, here it's called HSE, High School Certificate. I remember feeling like I was struggling in chemistry class. It was like holding up the pieces of a puzzle. I had to hold up each individual piece and I had to pay. It was like a lot of mental energy was expended on constantly focusing on holding up individual pieces, suspending them in the air at the same time until I finally locked the final piece in place. And suddenly the puzzle just went click. And then it just like sat there in the air by itself.
Mm. I'm thinking about that with you and history.
Oh, he's back.
I'm back. Your dog is not barking. Have you noticed? I'm very stern.
We were just saying like, yeah, it's kind of like, I don't know, if you've ever seen like an arch being built, it's really unstable until you put the arch brick thing. The keystone. Until you put the keystone in and then everything locks together and it becomes one of the strongest architectural structures. Mm. I find learning is the same way. If people try and get me to learn like individual things, I have to constantly hold up each bloody brick. But then once it's in a system, it's contextualized, it all fits together. There's a reason to it. It's a process. It's stable. It's there. I can call it whenever I need it.
Sorry. Should we go on to the actual fifth question now?
Yeah.
So what are your hopes for the future?
Us getting distracted in a podcast?
Yeah. No.
Amazing.
So what are your hopes for the future?
Oh, gosh. I'd like to survive the next time. I'd like to survive the next 2 years of med school.
Mm-hmm. Maybe that's...
I'd like to create a life where I am able to follow my passions, meet someone I fall in love with and create a life with them, stay close to family, existential questions. I guess, I've sort of resigned myself to the fact that as humans, we tend not to be able to leave physical legacies. They're accidents rather than purposeful things. You know, unless you're a Cleopatra or a pharaoh, you don't tend to leave a physical legacy that lasts for millennia. If by luck you happen to become a president or a prime minister and do something, that's generally luck, the same way that something goes viral on the internet, it's more luck than purposeful intentional effect. But you know, particularly, I don't know, Tess, maybe this is helpful to you, maybe it's not, a lot of the kind of aid work and voluntary stuff in resource limited settings around the world has kind of taught me that the legacies we leave are the investments we make in other people. Yeah. You know, like I was chatting to a friend the other day, he's in Papua New Guinea running the COVID hospital there. And, he was going, mate, I'm so frustrated because I train these incredible nurses up and they become amazing. And then they go off somewhere else and I start from scratch again. And I know the second I leave here, the systems I've built are just going to be, you know, torn down within a week. And I said, yeah, I mean, yes, like that's how things go. He goes, but what's the point? And I go, the point is, why do you think they keep taking these brilliant nurses away from you? Because you keep investing in them and making them shine and they become even more brilliant nurses. And then they need to send them somewhere else to go lead other teams. Stop beating yourself up. You're investing in people. That's your legacy. That's, you know, in 20 years time, the nurses you've helped train will be saving thousands more lives. That's your legacy. But you can't touch that. It's not a pyramid that you can go take photos with. It's not a Wikipedia page that you can see, you know, a fancy name and an OBE after.
It's not even a book. I mean, I think a lot of people, particularly when they get a bit older, and I am obviously substantially older than either of you, they sort of start thinking, well, maybe I should write a book. Maybe that would be something that I can sort of leave to you know, subsequent generations. And it may be maybe that's still valid, but I think the reason to write the book is because people now want to read it, or the reason to do the podcast is because people now need to listen to it, not because it's going to be some sort of lasting memorial to yourself. And I think that's absolutely right. I mean, it can sound a little bit like a Facebook meme to say that it's about investing to people, but it's actually happens to be true. But it actually happens to be true. What?
It's Facebook meme. Maybe you are old.
Yeah, well, I'm really old. Well, I was just about to make a sincere point, Tess, but that's fine.
As you were.
But I think it does happen to be true, and I think I'm in a sort of similar-ish position, you know, of thinking if I stop doing what I'm doing and working really hard on the service I've tried to sort of keep afloat for sort of 12 years, you know, if I was to leave, it would change radically. Fall apart isn't quite the right way of putting it, but it would change radically, and a lot of things that I have built would be torn down and rebuilt in a different way. But
I still would have had
an influence.
Well, no, don't turn me down.
I'm not turning you down.
No. Oh, Dad. Okay, you said that you... Okay. Point is, I am your child. You made me. You said the things that you have made will be torn down. And I said, oh, no, I don't want to be torn down. And then...
Not you. Stuff at work.
I know, Dad. I know.
Are you trying to explain a clever joke to an old man at this point?
You're not an old man. Fine.
Okay, I don't know how we're going to edit this bit. But yes, yeah, I mean, it's also true. I will kind of, I have created three children and we'll see how they go. But I think we've finished sort of, we've gone through our questions. Was there anything else that you particularly, either of you particularly wanted to kind of reflect on before we close things off?
Yeah, I have a question for Tess.
Hello.
Tess, what is something that you as a young adult adolescent would like to ask me that maybe I can offer my perspective or experience as another younger person?
Oh, I don't know. Oh, that's scary. I haven't thought of anything. I can't think of anything specific, but I would really love to hear any advice that you'd like to give me.
What I would say is false confidence is the same as confidence to everyone else who's watching. And I found that there are a lot of times in my life where I felt acutely aware of how different I was from other people, but that I was able to turn situations around a lot by putting on a false, confident kind of almost acting. Like, I really enjoyed acting as a kid, and I think it's literally just acting. Yeah. It's such a wonderful skill, and it's just, it totally enamors people when you are able to come with confident but respect, kind of confident but respectful approach. And our ability to remember things about people and pay them compliments about things which we would perceive and observe, which a lot of people wouldn't, can totally make people's day, and they'll remember for years. Like, I've had people who've come up to me and said, you know, 3 years ago, you told me that I looked really great with, you know, this eyeliner. And since then, I have always worn that eyeliner and gotten more compliments about it. But you were the first person to compliment me on that. And I felt like, oh, wow. Like, I literally just like noticed that they were wearing a new eyeliner and said, oh, I really like your new eyeliner. It looks great on you. And like, did I think they looked incredible? Like, no, I just thought they looked like nice. And I was just like, oh, it's a change. I'll remark on it. And it boosted their confidence in dating. And then, you know, they found a boyfriend and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, so I would say that false confidence and real confidence are just kind of a spectrum. You start falsely confident and then you end up truly confident. So use it. And our ability to pick up on subtle things in other people is totally a gift that we should exploit for other people's benefit and our own, because it's so useful. The other day I had a patient who was, I've kind of had a string of patients like this, a young kind of teenager who was really drunk.
Right.
And I just picked up like a hint of something that like just something was slightly off. No one else picked it up. And I kind of like sat him down and said, "Hey, can we chat about your mental health? Is that all right?" And he kind of just burst into tears and we ended up having a 1-hour discussion. And I ended up sending him to his GP to get a mental health care plan and see a psychologist and end up on the phone with his mom on speakerphone with him. And I've had like 5 of these now. And I think we are good at picking up subtle things in other people. And I just encourage you to trust your gut on it because it will often serve you well.
Mm. I mean, yeah, I've had a lot of people, a lot of my friends who have been struggling with like mental health and stuff, and I pick up stuff that other people don't pick up. Although a lot of my other friends are, as I mentioned, not neurotypical. So they will also pick up on those things. So I'm not the only one, but I 100% am with you there. It is definitely a gift. Although having a lot of people's mental health. Hang on, let me start that again. Well, it can be quite stressful having lots of people being lots of people's outlet for their mental health, but I'm really happy that I can help them with that. And I think the benefits that it's giving them are 100% worth it, because honestly, all it's doing is making me worried for them. But that's like the whole point. Like if there's something happening with their life that's worrying, you'd want to know about it. You'd want to be able to worry about that rather than them just carrying on in silence. And it really is a gift.
I think it's a good point. Yeah. It's a double-edged sword. I think you've touched on something which is really important, and I think you'll develop as you grow in experience, which is you can keep space for someone and you can recognize someone, but you don't have to become their therapist. Mm-hmm. It's really important to stay their friend. Yeah. And you can check in on someone. But I found the more I, you know, grow in as a kind of health professional, and the more as you get older, the problems your friends have get bigger and more complicated. I've had to learn oftentimes the hard way, because I take on other people's stuff too much, how to kind of set boundaries and go, "I'm your friend. I have noticed something's not right. We can talk about it, and you can kind of have your like immediate kind of outpouring to me to decompress, like letting the lid off the kettle. But then it's very much time for me to go, okay, you need to speak to a professional, because we will ruin our friendship if I take on that role for you. We won't stay friends. I will become your therapist, and that's not healthy for you or me." And then like, instead of asking them how they're going, it's how you're going with your therapist. Good, not so good. Or like, you know, when's the last time you saw, I mean, obviously you ask someone how they're going, but you don't therapize them. You don't counsel them. You're just like, "How's things? Do you want to go for a walk?" As opposed to, "How's things? Let's talk about it on Facebook for an hour. And let's process how you're feeling."
I know.
Because going for a walk will, apart from anything else, allow you to notice some squirrels.
Yeah. It can be quite hard as a young person to not set those boundaries, especially because obviously my friends are also young people and they cannot seek help without their parents' permission. And man, some of my friends have some bad parents. Like, so it's really can be quite hard to set those boundaries, because if I don't talk to them, it's going to be quite hard for them to find someone to talk to.
That's true to an extent, but it's not actually quite accurate that young people can't seek help without the knowledge.
I have set those boundaries. That's not.
And also, Tess, it's such a good point. And apologies, I'm jumping in here. I used to think exactly the same thing. I was like, if not me, then who? I'm like, you know, this person is special and their situation is unique, and no one out there is able to access them the way I am. And so even though it's not right, and even though it's not properly like good boundaries, I'm just going to have to carry the burden of their load for a bit to help them. And do you know what? The more experience I've had in this, the more I've realized that actually there are all these accessible services and other people out there that I didn't know about. And the only way I've learned this is by speaking to people who are in the know. So speaking to welfare people and social workers and psychologists, and it's taken me years and I'm still discovering new things. Like, you know, there are all these services that I just didn't know existed. And so what I tend to do now is I have a group of people who are like my experts that I go to, and they're friends, and I go, hey, I've got a person who's got this issue and they've got this personality and they haven't been able to find anyone. Where can I go? And they'll be like, oh, have you heard about this? And I'll say, no, like I haven't heard about this special niche service. They're like, oh yeah, get them to call this service up. It's completely anonymous and free. I was like, oh, cool. And sometimes it does mean involving parents, but a lot of the time it doesn't. And sometimes parents being involved is a good thing, even though it doesn't feel like it. Not always, but sometimes.
Yeah.
What I would say is if you have a GP or a psychologist, use that person as a resource. I use my GP and my psychologist as a resource to say, hey, I've actually got this friend who's got a problem. Where can I take them to? Because that's taking care of my mental health as well. It's taking a burden off me.
Yes, that's right.
It's getting them the right help.
I just want to clarify, I'm just for listeners and stuff, that I'm not saying that my friends are relying on me entirely for their mental health.
Oh, for sure.
And
I
feel trapped and I'm, you know, slowly dying or anything like that. It's just, it can be quite hard sometimes. And, you know, everything is hard sometimes, especially these kind of things. And what was I going to say? Oh, no. But I don't want to put across that I don't like my friends and that I'm not happy to provide a bit of support for them when they need it. And I don't want people to think that I am this therapist friend, because my friends are very emotionally intelligent and they know that I'm not a therapist and they know where to find this stuff. I think it's just giving them the extra push. And this goes for a lot of young people and teens, giving them the extra push to actually go to these sites, because there's Childline and all that kind of stuff. And people know that it's there, but they just don't really tend to think that their situation is important enough to like go to this person, or in another case, that their issue is not going to be able to be solved by these people. And obviously, if you call Childline, they're not going to immediately be able to, you know, fix all of your issues and you're suddenly going to be fine, but they might help you find a better way to process it and deal with it mentally. So the problem's not going to disappear, but the effects of the problem might. And that's the main reason that you should be going to these people. And that's, I don't know. I've just said a load of stuff and I don't have a lovely conclusion to draw all in.
I think it just comes back to, I guess, it sounds like you're doing a lot better than I am, because I love my friends, I have overburdened myself and had unhealthy boundaries before trying to straddle being a friend and kind of therapizing a bit, but I'm glad you're not. But I very much say it as a kind of to you / more actually to people who are listening to this, maybe, who I hope, if anyone's still listening, it's something to be aware of, because I think it's an easy trap to fall into.
I think I hope people are still listening, but whether they are or not, it's an important conversation to have, because this isn't just about, you know, we start just talking about the diagnosis and just talking about, you know, what's it like having ADHD or autism or this, but actually, you know, the stories that we tell, the stories that we get from people are about their lives, and it's everything. It is the mental health and it is the friends and it is the relationships, and that's what makes them still fascinating. Because if it was just about the diagnosis, then we wouldn't be able to keep producing episodes, because they would be the same.
So
I know I absolutely think that the conversation is valuable. Having said which, we probably need to wrap it up at some point before it becomes uneditable. So thank you very much, a medical student who may be called Aidan, for joining us today. for a really wide-ranging and brilliant chat. Well, usually we say, how do people find you who want to talk to you? They don't. But I'm sure you are a person who, in your role, in your life, will be an influence on lots of people, and your investment in people, you know, will pay off in all sorts of interesting ways.
I mean, look, if anyone wants to reach out, they're welcome to get in touch with you, and you can put them in touch with me.
Yeah, good point.
Tess, it's been so cool talking to you.
Thank you very much. Thank you so much. It's been lovely talking to you.
Take care.
All right. Bye-bye.
So there we go. That was Aidan, a wonderful chap that he is.
Yes, this is the outro.
This is the outro. Right, Tess, how do you think things are going with podcasts? Is there anything you want to be doing differently?
I don't know. You guys could tell us.
Because we've sort of had a few episodes since Christmas. We've got a few ideas, but suggestions for people who want to come on, want to talk to us. And it doesn't matter who you are and what your story is. What's really amazing about the podcast is giving the opportunity to people to tell their stories, because just very often it's the first time they've told it, even if they're somebody who kind of, you know, is quite outgoing and sociable. And when it's all in one place, it just sort of comes together in this amazing way. So if you are one of those people, it doesn't matter what your story is. We want to hear it.
I mean, it probably does to a certain extent, but...
What, if you're a serial killer?
Yeah, if you're going to come to this podcast and admit for the first time that you've committed several felonies, I mean, we're really not the best place to go.
No, I would go to the police.
Yeah.
Okay, so if you haven't killed anyone and you're neurodiverse and you want to come on the podcast...
I mean, qualifications are pretty open, I've got to be honest.
Feel free.
Yes.
In the meantime, you can contact us at...
Extraordinary Brains.
extraordinarybrainspod@gmail.com, and all of our social media tags are
on the website.
Extra Brains Pod, Tess.
Okay.
Honestly.
Message us on Instagram. Message me on Instagram.
No, you do the Instagram.
I don't do the Instagram. You do. You say that I do the Instagram, but you do it.
Bye.
You're a fraud.